Great. Let's have the marshal call court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Riley, Judge Flory, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on March 24, 2021. We are here for our third case on our oral calendar this morning, a 20-0346 State of Minnesota versus, is it Bram or Brame?
Brame, Your Honor.
Brame. Thank you very much, counsel. You will see a running clock of your time in just a moment. You each will have 15 minutes for your primary argument and an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant if you choose to use that. I'm going to ask that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. Identify yourself before you begin your argument this morning because these proceedings are being recorded. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jason Steffen, Assistant Public Defender, and I represent Mr. Brame in this appeal. We are here today because Curtis Brame was convicted of selling a narcotic drug. Even though the police did not seize the substance he sold, the crime lab did not test the substance he sold, the jury was never shown the substance he sold. In the absence of that physical evidence that Brame sold a narcotic drug, the jury's conviction on count one cannot be sustained. We are also here today because Mr. Brame, his trial counsel made a series of inexplicably bad moves at trial, and that of course culminated in his conviction. Mr. Brame attempted to obtain post-conviction relief by raising an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, but the district court summarily denied his petition, even though he alleged numerous facts that taken together raise legitimate questions about his counsel's performance and warrant an evidentiary hearing to develop the record on that issue. Turning first of all to that first issue, the sufficiency of the evidence on the third degree sale conviction, the state of course had at trial the burden of proof to prove each element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. One of the elements, and the one I take to be most in dispute here, is that the substance Brame sold was in fact a narcotic drug. Again, there was no, the substance that the testimony was he gave to another person was never obtained by the police. It was never tested. It was not in evidence.
I was going to ask you something, Mr. Steffen, in your reply brief. One of the alternate theories for this is that it's plausible that the drugs that were recovered were for Brame's personal use, or that Brame made money by selling fake drugs. Was that ever brought up at trial or argued?
That was not argued specifically at trial. The state's theory of the case was that Brame had some drugs that some of them he sold or gave to another person who's identified as the quote unquote pregnant lady in the record. And then these other drugs that were ultimately found were somehow connected.
It seems that the evidence would support that he liked to smoke marijuana.
There's certainly, we would concede that there is evidence of drug possession for sure. That's not what we're arguing here. The sole issue is, was there sufficient evidence to support the sale conviction? So
can you help me out here? What is actually the legal proposition that you're arguing here? Is it that in a sale case that it is mandatory that the state produce a certain quality of evidence? I mean, here there's eyewitness testimony, there's circumstantial evidence, and I'm just wondering if there's some litmus test as to the quality of evidence that you're either is find some support in the case law or that you're advocating today?
Well, my understanding of the case law is not that there is a test where there has to be, for example, the state absolutely has to have, you know, a laboratory test, for example. There's clearly cases where a sale conviction was affirmed in the absence of, you know, the production and testing of the drugs. However, those cases involve much more compelling circumstantial evidence than we have in this case. The state refers to the Olhausen case, for example, and that was a case where there was a sale that was upheld, you know, in the absence of obtaining and testing those drugs. But that was a situation where Mr. Olhausen, there was a prior agreement between Olhausen and a undercover officer to purchase methamphetamine. The undercover officer, who had, you know, years of experience in narcotics, positively identified the substance as methamphetamine based on his observations. We had the defendant's own representations about that substance. We had a co-defendant saying that this was methamphetamine.
I don't disagree with you that the cases that you're citing have a quantum of evidence that's superior to what is in this case. But what I'm looking for is there a bar here? Is there some legal, threshold that the state has to cross in order to get a conviction under this statute? And as opposed to us applying the traditional evidentiary tests when direct evidence or circumstantial evidence substantiates the conviction. I'm just wondering if you're advocating for something different than the standards that we normally apply in the insufficiency cases.
No, Your Honor, I'm not advocating for a new rule here, merely that the existing rules or the existing case law supports the proposition that in this particular case, there was not enough evidence to sustain a conviction for the third degree sale.
And is that because the circumstances proved don't substantiate the conviction, or you're classifying the eyewitness testimony and not as direct evidence? I mean, why is that? I mean, I get the comparisons to the other cases, but I'm trying to use our standard of review framework here to understand how you get from point A to point B.
Well, if I understand the question correctly, the direct evidence which was given in the case was Ms. Brewston's testimony that Mr. Brame gave something to this other woman, the alleged buyer. She did not positively identify this substance by anything other than her statement about what Mr. Brame said about this substance. So first of all, as far as the sale is concerned, we're not disagreeing that there is some direct evidence of a sale in the sense, at least, of a transfer of something from Brame to this third party. However, the state has to do more, of course, than prove that there was a sale. They have to prove that the sale was of a narcotic drug. And our contention would be that that is based on circumstantial evidence, and that the circumstantial evidence is insufficient in this case to warrant that conviction. Does that help clarify?
I thought that the girlfriend, I guess I'll call her, the complaining witness, saw someone shooting up, using needles and shooting something into her arm in the garage.
Yes, and I will say the record is a little bit unclear about the exact sequence of events, but my understanding is that Ms. Brewston, who is the girlfriend, as you say, she arrived home that night, observed Mr. Brame along with, I believe, two other individuals who appeared to be using what appeared to her to be illegal drugs. And at some point during that night, she observed Brame handing something to one of the people in the garage, who was this pregnant woman. That's my understanding of her observations.
So Mr. Stephan, I don't want to, I'm sorry if I interrupted Judge Riley. I don't want to belabor this too long, because I know there's another issue that you want to get to, but my difficulty with this argument is that you're what's somewhat unique about this case is your client testified. He denied selling drugs, and he denied that the drugs that were found to have his DNA on them were his drugs. So the jury heard that. They made a credibility determination between his testimony and what the other direct and circumstantial evidence was, and they obviously rejected it. So I'm having a hard time seeing what other, it seems to me the evidence would support the verdict. And so if it's a circumstantial analysis, you know, what other reasonable explanations are that the jury considered, and none were raised other than I didn't sell and the drugs ain't mine. I'm having a hard time getting to that step in your argument.
Yes. Well, as to the credibility question, I mean, that's a good point, because this was essentially a credibility, a question of Ms. Brewston's credibility. She was the only eyewitness that the state called to testify about what happened that night.
Well, we don't review credibility determinations, and this doesn't strike me as the rare case where we would do that.
That's correct. And I wasn't suggesting that the court needs to question her credibility. The issue is that her testimony wasn't, for example, I'm a heroin user, I've been using heroin for, you know, 10 years, I know it when I see it, that was definitely heroin, right? Her statement was, I saw Mr. Brehm doing something with some substance and a scale at some point prior to this sale, not clear when that took place. He told me it was heroin. I took his word for it, essentially. So her testimony might establish that he gave something to another person that he claimed was heroin. But again, that isn't sufficient. That's not proof that—
But the evidence was that both methamphetamine and heroin was found in the apartment with his DNA on it. Doesn't that lend credibility to what she said? From a jury's perspective?
The drugs that were found, there is no testimony that the drugs that were found were sort of, you know, part of the same packaging, so to speak, as the drugs that he gave to this other individual. It is plausible that he was using methamphetamine and or heroin himself, and that he gave some other kind of controlled substance that's not a narcotic drug to this woman, or that he gave her a simulated controlled substance.
But isn't that the point of the circumstantial evidence test, that we look at all of the circumstances and then look at the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from those circumstances? And given that we do have a verdict here, a contrary verdict to your client, I feel like you're isolating certain circumstances and saying these alone are not enough, while ignoring what's going on around all the rest of those circumstances, which is problematic for me.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying, and I mean, my response to that would be the cases where courts have upheld convictions for sale or even possession in the absence of the acquisition and testing of drugs contain circumstantial evidence that is simply, you know, substantially more compelling than the circumstantial evidence in this case. Again, Olhausen, Gruber is another case where there was no testing, but, you know, it was they were packaged pharmaceuticals that could be kind of identified readily by an expert and so forth.
I was going to ask you about the judge's post-conviction order. It's one of the clearer orders that I've read recently from a post-conviction court, where she just marched through each of your instances or examples of ineffective assistance of counsel. How did she get it wrong, and how did she abuse her discretion in that order?
So the problem with the judge's response to that petition is that she essentially takes each allegation and explains why it could, in theory, be a reasonable trial strategy. There's actually two problems there. First of all, if you view all of these errors together, no reasonable defense attorney would take an approach that included all of these errors. The second problem with that is that we have no way of knowing whether this was in fact a trial strategy or, lack of preparation, lack of experience, attorney didn't get enough sleep. I mean, we just have no way of knowing without an evidentiary hearing where we can ask him those questions. And if the attorney, is able to provide an explanation as to how this was trial strategy, okay. But
why does that matter, Mr. Stephan, if the first prong of Strickland is an objective standard of reasonableness? What does it matter what the lawyer was subjectively thinking if the judge determined that these objectively were reasonable trial strategy?
And I'm sorry, I'm almost out of time. Can I finish answering that question?
Yes, go ahead, counsel.
The issue there is, first of all, if you take all of these alleged errors together, and again, this court needn't find that they're accurate or inaccurate, just that Mr. Brame has alleged, sufficient facts to warrant a hearing. If you take all of these together, no reasonable defense attorney would, sort of do all of these things in a trial as part of a strategy. The other issue there is that the judge's statements are that these were trial strategy or that these should be construed as trial strategy. Trial strategy should not be, a complete bar to ineffective assistance claims as the case law indicates. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. Any other questions from the panel? All right, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Stephan. Let's reset the clock, Ms. McGillick, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, may it please the court. Opposing counsel, my name is Karen McGillick. I'm an assistant attorney general hearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'd like to address the first issue first, and we didn't really get into it a lot in terms of the whether or not there was evidence of a sale, and I outlined this pretty quickly in my brief, but there is definitely sufficient direct evidence that a sale of drugs occurred on the night in question. We have a direct eyewitness that saw appellant first weighing out and packaging drugs at a time either on that date or shortly before that date. And then she witnessed him actually give some of those drugs to the pregnant woman in the garage. So we have direct evidence that a sale occurred. And really, I think what the defense is mostly challenging is whether or not there is sufficient evidence of the fact that that was a narcotic drug.
So Ms. McGillick, defense, on that issue, the briefs seem to concentrate on, what BB saw in terms of the exchange and things, but the definition of sale is broader than that, including possession with intent to distribute, and which circumstantially could be packaging and scales and things like that. Was that theory ever put before the jury in terms of whether or not there was a sale here?
I don't believe it was specifically argued that it fell under the intent to distribute portion of the statute. I think the state more focused on the giveaway language. So, sell is including giving away the substance. But I do think that, distributing or possessing with intent, intent to distribute would also have fallen in the same category. So either way, the state under either theory could have met that burden of proof. But there was clear evidence that she saw him hand it to the pregnant woman, which would meet the definition of giveaway. And so under that portion of the language of the statute, there is direct evidence of that sale. And, defense counsel
is, but is there, I don't think there, what is the direct evidence that the thing that she saw being sold was a narcotic? I think that so is she, what, that's where Mr. Stephan says there's a gap.
So what we have here is a very short timeline of what she observed in terms of what happened at the dining room table. Now we have a rock-like substance that he is processing at the dining room table. He is taking a chunk-like substance. He is dividing it down into a powder. He is distributing it into small bags. He's weighing it on a scale. And we don't have a specific time and to when she saw that. But what we do know is that when the police arrived in response to a 911 call, that scale is still sitting where she said it was on the table. So I think we can, the presumption is that that happened in a very short amount of time, either that day or the night before, but that he was processing those drugs. And then her testimony is somewhat scattered and somewhat goes around, but you can tell that she is talking about the fact that she witnessed him giving drugs to this woman. And I think the circumstantial evidence establishes that it was likely those same exact drugs, and those are the same drugs that she was then asked to hide in her bra that day. We also have extensive testimony that, or, you know, extensive evidence that he is a drug dealer. You know, that is not in dispute, that she had evidence that this is what he does to make money. He is a drug dealer. And that one of the other women present with his male friend that night was another one of his drug buyers, separate from the pregnant woman. And she was shooting up drugs in the garage as well on the same evening. This idea that the defendant could have been personally using the drugs or that these were fake drugs, there's simply no evidence in the record to support that theory, none whatsoever. There's no evidence whatsoever that the defendant uses heroin or methamphetamine. And the only evidence we have is that he was in the garage using alcohol and smoking marijuana, but there's no evidence that he used these substances, nor is there any evidence that the victim, BB, used these substances. But what we do have is that the drugs that were from, that were in her bra that she held and hid on her person that night and stashed in the speaker before she ran out of the house to call 911, those were tested. So this isn't a situation where a mystery drug was given away and we have no physical evidence of it. We have the other five bags. Those bags were sent to the VCA. They were confirmed. One of them contained methamphetamine and rock-like substance. You know, it matches the physical description of what she saw being processed at the dining room table. And that bag of methamphetamine has the defendant's DNA on it. Then we have the four other bags of heroin, but also one of those bags that was tested also contained the defendant's DNA. So when you put all of these circumstances together, and again, the standard of review is very clear that we have to view the evidence as a whole and in the light most favorable to the conviction. And when we do that in this case, there is a clear chain that connects these circumstances together to prove that the substance that he sold was in fact heroin or alternatively methamphetamine, but either way, a narcotic drug. There's simply no evidence that in his drug dealing activities that he was ever dealing fake substances or some other reason to doubt that the drugs that he sold to the pregnant woman that night were not the same exact drugs that were remaining in her bra that she was concealing. And we know that because he showed consciousness of guilt by wanting her to be the one to hold the drugs so that he would not get in trouble if something were to happen. And we know from his abusive behavior towards her that he was very concerned about her calling the police and in fact physically intimidated her not to do so. So when we have these circumstances added together, there is strong evidence here. It's certainly as strong, or at least coming close to as strong as in Olhausen or in Woldenlassee. I mean, we have very similar circumstances there where the actual drugs sold may never have been recovered and tested, but the circumstances as a whole established what that drug was. And in this case, the state was able to prove through this combination of direct and circumstantial evidence that the substance that he gave away to that pregnant woman that night was a narcotic drug. I also think it's helpful that we in this case do have the defendant's testimony. And as Your Honor pointed out, the jury was able to consider and weigh his version of the events versus the victim's version of events. And they were able to make a credibility determination and find that he was not credible. And at the same time, he maybe unwillingly offered some corroborating evidence by putting another woman in the garage that night that matched the description. He wasn't aware if she was pregnant or not, but he put another woman there, the same woman that was identified as the buyer. So even his own testimony lends credibility to what the victim testified that she saw that evening. There's compelling circumstances. There's simply not another hypothesis that's rational in terms of this case. So the state has certainly met its burden of proof. Unless there's additional questions on that issue, I'd be happy to move on to the second issue. The second issue is whether the post-conviction court abused its discretion by denying post-conviction relief without a hearing. And in this case, there was certainly not any type of an abuse of discretion, because in order to obtain a hearing, the defense had a burden to at least put forward facts that, if proven true, would have shown some sort of a Strickland meeting one of the prongs of the Strickland test, the first prong. And in this case, none of the issues that were raised can do that. Each of the issues that were alleged in terms of ineffective assistance of counsel, none of which would qualify. They were all trial strategy decisions, and the very kind of trial strategy decisions that are not reviewed on appeal. And so because they were unable to meet that sort of initial test of showing that they could actually prevail, or that their facts, if true, would have entitled them to some sort of post-conviction relief, the post-conviction court was well within its discretion to deny relief without a hearing. Unless there are additional questions, I am happy to rest on the arguments that are in my brief, and we would ask that the convictions be affirmed.
But, and I do have one question, but Mr. Steffen says that how do we know it was trial strategy without an evidentiary hearing? How did the judge come to that conclusion in her order? Finding that it was trial strategy as opposed to just ineffectiveness. What is your response to that argument?
My response, Your Honor, is that there's very clear case law identifying the type of issues that were raised here as being strategic in nature. And so when we have things about not cross-examining the victim about her felony convictions, or failing to object to certain testimony, or I'm trying to think of some of the other examples here, asking questions that the defendant later found objectionable, or maybe questioned why those questions were asked. These are all the things that we have very strong case law going back a long time establishing that these are the very nature of trial strategy decisions. And the judge was able to look at them and also look at the record and compare some of the complaints that were being made about him to say, why, not only are they the type of things that fall within trial strategy, but we have case law, or I can see from looking at the record what counsel was attempting to do. Here he was attempting to attack the victim's credibility, for example, by pointing out that this gang affiliation, that the cops never found any evidence to support it. There was a solid strategy in trying to undermine her credibility by asking that question. So I think between the case law and the fact that the judge could find reasons why it made sense for counsel to do what he did were both reasons that there really wasn't a need to develop the record further on those issues, and it would be inappropriate to do so under the existing case law. If there are no other questions, then I will rest and ask again that the convictions be affirmed, and thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions from the panel? All right, thank you very much. Let's just get the clock going here, Mr. Steffen. Anytime you're ready for rebuttal, if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. So first of all, to address the last point that Ms. McGillick raised, it is true that there is case law that says, you know, for example, failure to impeach a witness doesn't in and of itself constitute ineffective assistance of counsel. The problem in this particular case is that Brame is alleging not just, you know, one or two or even three errors of that nature during the course of the trial, but a whole sort of systemic failure to really challenge the state's case and in fact to elicit information that was very harmful to his client. So if you take all of these things together, it's very difficult to say, again, without an evidentiary hearing, that this was some sort of grand trial strategy rather than a lack of effective assistance. The respondent says, you know, it's obvious that Brame's attorney was trying to undermine the credibility of the victim, Ms. Brewston. But if that were the case, then he would have, he would have impeached her with these prior convictions in which she had lied under oath to the government, which is directly relevant to her providing testimony in a criminal case. He would have not, impugned his own client's credibility by, eliciting information about his gang affiliations, his alleged gang affiliations, or...
Well, apparently your client made the decision to testify, and the judge, the post-conviction judge, who was the trial judge, said he testified warts and all.
Yes. I think that's, I mean, that's fair that he didn't minimize certain things about his behavior. However, he wasn't, I mean, it's not as if he stood up and just started talking. His counsel was asking him particular questions, such as whether he had ever, you know, harmed Ms. Brewston's cats, for example.
But that may have been to blunt the sting, because once a person takes a stand, they're subject to cross-examination, especially a criminal defendant.
Well, there had been no testimony at all in the case up to that point regarding any kind of animal abuse. So, I mean, it really sort of seemed to come out of left field, I would imagine, from the perspective of a juror. But in any case, the point is, again, I agree with you that taken in and of itself, one can imagine why a defense attorney would want to bring out that particular piece of information. But again, if you add up all of these errors that Brame is alleging his counsel made, it starts to look much less like a trial strategy and much more like incompetence, frankly. And again, this court needn't decide that Mr. Brame's counsel provided him with ineffective assistance. This court simply needs to decide whether he alleged sufficient facts to warrant an evidentiary hearing. And again, we would submit that he did, and we would ask that the court remand for an evidentiary hearing on the post-conviction claims. Just very briefly, back to the issue of count one, the sale. The respondent indicates again here that there's no evidence that Mr. Brame could have been, you know, dealing in fake substances, simulated controlled substances. But the Robinson case points out that this is a very common practice, and it wasn't, you know, Brame didn't need to prove that he was selling simulated controlled substances. The burden of proof was on the state to prove that what he transferred was in fact a narcotic drug. And again, there is no direct evidence of that, and the circumstantial evidence is not compelling enough to warrant a conviction. So we are asking this court to overturn the conviction on count one. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Counsel, thank you very much. The matter is submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.